So, you've got that computer architecture and networks exam tomorrow, huh?
Yeah, and you're feeling like maybe you should have paid more attention during class.
Just a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
But hey, don't worry, we've all been there, right?
Right. We're gonna help you cram everything you need into your brain for that exam.
Think of it like a late night study session at a cafe, right? We've got coffee, we've got maybe a pastry.
And we've definitely got the information you need to ace this thing. We've got the prof
Oh,
slides.
and some awesome notes from that one classmate who always seems to like know everything.
Plus some practice exam questions.
Perfect. So let's jump right in, shall we? Let's start with number systems. I remember back in the day, binary code was like it's like looking at
Yeah,
hieroglyphics.
total gibberish.
Totally. So decimal, binary, hexadecimal. What's the deal with all these different systems?
Well, think of it like this. Computers, they operate on electricity, right? On or off. So their language is binary, which is, just two digits, zero and one. And each zero or one, that's a bit. It's like the smallest piece of information a computer can handle.
Okay, so binary is like the computer's native tongue. But why do we need decimal and hexadecimal?
Right, so decimal, that's base 10, that's what we humans use every day. But imagine trying to write out a huge number with just zeros and ones. It gets messy fast.
Yeah, I can imagine.
That's where hexadecimal comes in. It's base 16, it uses 0, 9, and then AF. Basically, it's a shorthand way to represent those long binary strings.
So it's like a translator between us and the computer.
Exactly. Now, the slides mention converting between these systems, and you'll definitely see that on the exam. Let's take a look at an example, converting 562 from decimal to binary.
How do we tackle that?
Okay, so we need to find the biggest powers of 2 that fit into 562. So the largest power of 2 less than 562 is 512, which is 2 to the power of 9. So we put a 1 in that place, subtract 512 from 562, and we're left with 50.
Okay, I'm following. What's next?
All right, the next largest power of 2 that fits into 50 is 32, which is 2 to the fifth. So we put a 1 there as well. And we keep doing this until we've accounted for the whole decimal value. In the end, we get 10,0010010, and that's the binary for 562.
So it's all about breaking down the decimal number into powers of 2. What about going the other way? Converting from binary to decimal. Your slides have that example. 001.0110.111.
Right. So basically, we do the reverse. Each position in a binary number, it represents a power of 2, increasing from right to left. So we multiply each digit by its power of 2 and then add up the results.
Got it. It's like each position has like a special value.
Right, like a code.
Okay, makes sense. Now, how do computers deal with text? We can't just type in ones and zeros.
Good point. That's where character encoding comes in. It's like imagine a giant lookup table that maps each character to a specific binary code. And your lecturer talks about a few encoding schemes, ASCII, extended ASCII, UTF-8.
ASCII, yeah, that's pretty old school, right?
It is, yeah. ASCII uses 7 bits per character. It covers, basic English letters, punctuation, numbers, and some control characters. Extended ASCII uses 8 bits, gives you 256 characters. But to represent like all the characters from different languages and emojis and stuff, you need UTF-8, which can use, up to 32 bits and handle millions of characters.
Whoa, that's a lot of characters. So like, if I wanted to write this as text in ASCII, how would that look in hexadecimal?
So each character in that string has a corresponding hexadecimal representation in the ASCII table. You can find these tables online. So this is text, translates to 54, 68, 69, 73, 20, 69, 73, 20, 74, 65, 78, 74 in hexadecimal.
Okay, that's not as bad as I thought. Now, what about images? They're made up of pixels, but how are those pixels stored and processed by the computer?
All right, so imagine a digital image, right? It's like a mosaic made of tiny squares called pixels. The more pixels you have, the higher the resolution, the sharper the picture looks. Each pixel is assigned a binary code that represents its color.
Okay, so how does the coding actually work? Is it different for black and white versus color images?
You got it. For a simple black and white image, you just need 1 bit per pixel. 0 for black, 1 for white.
Simple enough.
Grayscale images, you use 8 bits per pixel, so you can have different shades of gray. But color images get a little more complex. They use the RGB color model. So each pixel is actually represented by 24 bits, 8 bits each for red, green, and blue.
Ah, that's why it's called RGB.
Exactly.
So, like a 16 by 16 pixel image, like the one in the slides,
Oh.
would take up way more space if it's full color versus black and white.
Exactly. A black and white 16 by 16 image would need, let's see, only 32 bytes. A grayscale one would need 256 bytes. And a full color one, that would need 768 bytes.
Okay, that makes me rethink all those high-res photos on my phone.
Yeah.
Now, we've talked about numbers, text, images, all different types of data, but how does all that stuff get passed around? You know, how do they communicate? That's where networks come in, right?
Networks, exactly. They're the glue that holds the digital world together. They allow all those devices to connect, share information, resources, you name it.
So, like, the most basic definition of a network is just a bunch of connected devices.
That's it. A bunch of computers, smartphones, whatever, all linked together to exchange information.
So what are the pros and cons of connecting devices in a network?
Well, the pros, sharing resources like printers and files, accessing the internet, obviously, collaboration on projects, instant communication, that's all huge. Downsides, security risks, definitely something to think about. Networks can be vulnerable if they're not properly secured. And, you know, there's always the potential for network failures. Always fun.
Yeah, less fun.
So, yeah, you're weighing the benefits of connectivity against those potential risks.
Right. Makes sense. Now, the slides mention this thing called the OSI model. What's that all about and how does it relate to networks?
Okay. So the OSI model, imagine it like a layered cake where each layer represents a different stage in the network communication process. This model really helps to break down, you know, the complexity of networking into manageable chunks. But for this exam, you're going to want to focus on the TCP/IP model, the 5-layer one. It's in the diagrams from microchipdeveloper.com. Your lecturer is really emphasizing that one.
So no need to memorize all 7 layers of the OSI model, just the TCP/IP one.
That's right. Focus on TCP/IP. It'll be the foundation for a lot of the concepts in this course.
Okay, good to know. Let's talk about the physical stuff now. Network devices, modems, repeaters, hubs, bridges, switches, routers. What are all these things and what do they actually do?
Think of them as the traffic controllers of the network. Each one plays a specific role to make sure that data gets where it needs to go smoothly and efficiently.
Okay, so starting with modems, that's like our gateway to the internet, right?
Yeah, exactly. A modem, which stands for modulator demodulator, it acts as a translator between your computer's digital signals and those analog signals used by your internet service provider.
So it's like the language interpreter that lets our computers talk to the internet.
Precisely. It bridges that gap between your home network and the vast world of the internet.
Got it. What about repeaters? What's their role in this whole network orchestra?
Repeaters, they're like signal boosters. You know how signals can weaken over long distances?
Yeah.
Repeaters amplify the signal so it reaches its destination. Think of them like relay runners.
Passing that data baton. Oh. Okay, I like it. But the slides mention a drawback of repeaters. What's the catch?
Yeah, so while repeaters can extend the network's reach, they also amplify any noise that might be present in the signal.
Oh, so it's not a perfect solution.
Not quite.
Okay, what about hubs? Are they similar to repeaters?
Not really. Repeaters work at the physical layer, but hubs, they work at the data link layer. Think of a hub like a central broadcasting station. It receives data packets from one device and then broadcasts them to all the other devices connected to it.
Even if they're not the intended recipient.
Yep. Doesn't discriminate.
It seems a little inefficient, like sending a mass email when you only want to message one person.
Yeah, you're right. It can be. That's where bridges come in. Bridges are smarter than hubs. They learn the MA addresses of all the devices connected to the network and filter the traffic so data is only sent to the right segment.
Okay, so bridges are like traffic cops. They direct the data to the right lane.
Precisely.
Got it. Now, what about switches? Are they related to bridges?
Yeah, think of a switch as a multi-port bridge. It's essentially a bridge on steroids. It can handle multiple connections simultaneously and filter traffic between them.
So it's like the air traffic controller of a busy airport.
Exactly.
Making sure all those data packets reach their destinations without any collisions.
I got it.
Okay, finally, routers. They're like the rock stars of the internet. What makes them so special?
Routers are the most sophisticated devices in the whole network hierarchy. They connect different networks together, like your home network to the internet. And they do it using IP addresses to figure out the best path for the data packets. They even handle things like network address translation, so multiple devices on your home network can share one public IP address.
Whoa, they do all that. So they're like the global navigators of the internet, finding the most efficient routes across these massive networks.
Precisely. They're the unsung heroes that keep the internet running smoothly.
Okay, so we've covered the key players in the networking world. Now, networks aren't always perfect, right? Things can slow down, connections can drop. What are some of the factors that can affect network performance?
Right, so network performance can be affected by different types of delays. The slides mention propagation delay. That's just the time it takes for a signal to travel the physical distance.
So like the farther the distance, the longer it takes for the data to get there.
Yeah, just like sending a letter versus sending an email.
Makes sense. Are there other types of delays too?
Yep. Buffer delay, that's when data packets are temporarily stored in a buffer before being forwarded.
So it's like a layover at the airport.
Exactly. Then there's access delay. That's the time it takes for a device to actually get access to the transmission medium.
Okay.
And then finally, there's queue delay. That's the time a packet spends just waiting in a queue to be processed and forwarded, like a traffic jam on the information superhighway.
So we have propagation delay, buffer delay, access delay, and queue delay. Are those delays the same for all types of networks, like LANs versus WANs?
Not necessarily. In a LAN, the distances are short, so propagation delay is usually pretty minimal. But access and queue delays can be a problem, especially if a lot of devices are using the network. On the other hand, WANs, because of the long distances, propagation delay can be much higher.
So the type of network and the amount of traffic play a big role.
Yeah. Now let's dive into the Internet Protocol Suite, TCP/IP.
TCP/IP, yeah, it sounds important. What's the deal with that?
So TCP/IP, it's the language of the Internet. It's a set of protocols that control how data is transmitted across the Internet. It ensures that that messages are delivered reliably and efficiently. Think of it like the rule book for online communication.
Okay. And IPv4 addressing, that's a key part of this, right? What do we need to know about that for the exam? I've always been a little fuzzy on, you know, those numbers separated by dots.
Right. So those numbers are IP addresses, and they uniquely identify each device on a network. They're like the street addresses of the Internet. And each IPv4 address is a 32-bit number, usually written in dotted decimal notation, so it's easier for us humans to read.
Okay, like 192.168.1.1.
Exactly. Much easier than a long string of ones and zeros.
Definitely. But what about those different classes of IP addresses? I remember seeing class A, class C. What was all that about?
Okay, so those classes were part of the original IP addressing scheme, and it was designed to, you know, allocate addresses efficiently based on the size of the network. So class A networks, they had a small number of networks, but a large number of hosts per network. And a class C was the opposite, many networks, fewer hosts per network. But this system, it turned out to be pretty inflexible, which led to the development of CIDR, or classless interdomain routing.
CIDR, that sounds a bit more technical. How does that work?
CIDR is a more flexible way to allocate IP addresses using these things called variable length subnet masks. So instead of those fixed class boundaries, network administrators can divide up the address space into subnets of different sizes.
Okay, so CIDR is like custom tailoring for IP addresses.
Yeah.
Allows for a better fit.
Exactly.
Okay, so what are subnet masks and why are they so important?
A subnet mask, it's like a stencil that separates the network part of an IP address from the host part. It helps routers figure out, you know, which part of the address identifies the network and which part identifies a specific device on that network.
So like separating the zip code from the street address.
Precisely. And in CIDR notation, you'll see the IP address and then a slash and a number. That number tells you how many bits are used for the network part of the address.
Okay, so it's all starting to come together now. Now, you mentioned some examples of CIDR allocation, like allocating addresses from a 128.21.0.016 block. Can you break that down for me?
Sure. Let's say we have a 24 CIDR block. That means 24 bits are for the network prefix, leaving 8 bits for host addresses within that network. And with 8 bits, you have 2 to the power of 8, which is 256 possible combinations.
So 256 possible addresses within that block, but aren't some of those addresses reserved for special purposes?
You're right. Two addresses are always reserved, one for the network address itself and one for the broadcast address, which sends messages to all the devices on that subnet.
Okay, so that leaves us with 254 usable IP addresses for devices.
Got it. Now, besides CIDR, what other key protocols do we need to understand in this TCP/IP suite? So your lecture highlights ARP and DHCP as essential protocols. ARP, That's address resolution protocol. It helps devices find the MMAT address that's associated with a particular IP address.
Wait, MC address. Didn't we talk about those earlier?
Yeah, remember, each network interface card has a unique MC address, which is like a physical address that's assigned to the hardware.
Right, right.
So ARP acts like a bridge between those IP addresses and MC addresses.
So it's like using a phone book to find someone's home address based on their phone number.
Exactly. And then DHCP, that's Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, it automates the process of assigning those IP addresses to devices on the network.
So it's like a hotel concierge assigning rooms to guests.
Exactly. It makes sure each device has a unique IP address, and there's no need for any manual configuration.
So DHCP takes care of IP address allocation, and ARP helps devices find each other using those addresses. It's like teamwork.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
And what about those support protocols you mentioned, routing and NAT?
So routing protocols, they figure out the best path for data packets to travel across those networks. And NAT, that's network address translation, it lets multiple devices on a private network, like your home network, share a single public IP address.
Right. We talked about NAT briefly with routers.
Right. And it also helps conserve public IP addresses and enhances security.
Okay, that's clever. It's like having a single phone number for your whole house, even though everyone has their own extension.
Exactly. And your lecturer also mentioned some helpful tools like Wireshark and the ARP command. Wireshark lets you capture and analyze network traffic, and the ARP command, you can use that to view and manage the ARP cache on your computer.
Okay, so those tools can help us actually see these protocols in action. Now, let's ditch those cables and get into the wireless world. Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, infrared, it's like wireless is everywhere these days.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Wireless technologies have totally changed how we connect with devices. So infrared, that's mostly used for short-range communication, you know, like TV remotes and stuff. And Bluetooth, that was invented by Jap Hartson, that's also short-range, good for connecting devices like headphones and smartphones.
Okay, and Wi-Fi, that's like the king of wireless, right? Let's just surf the internet without being tethered to a cable.
Exactly. Well, Wi-Fi gives you those higher speeds and greater range than Bluetooth or infrared.
But Wi-Fi has come a long way, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's evolved like crazy. Every new generation has better speed, range, reliability. You know, we've gone from those early 802.11 B standards to the faster N, AC, and now Wi-Fi 6, which is also known as 802.11 and Mellanox.
Wow. So when I'm studying, should I focus on the differences between those Wi-Fi generations?
Yeah, definitely. Focus on the big changes that each generation brought. You know, things like MIMO, which uses multiple antennas to transmit data simultaneously. And there's OFDM, which splits the signal into multiple subcarriers to improve speed and robustness.
MIMO and OFDM. Okay, I'll make a note of those. Now, what about security in the wireless world? That's got to be a big concern, right? Anyone could potentially snoop on our data.
Absolutely. Security is crucial when it comes to wireless networks. So we've seen a bunch of security protocols, you know, starting with the old WEP, then the more robust WPA and WPA2, which use stronger encryption algorithms like AES and TKP. Always go for WPA2 or WPA3 if you can. And make sure your network uses a strong password.
Strong passwords, crucial for anything online. Okay, let's switch gears to HTTP and encryption. HTTP is what powers the web, but I've always been a little fuzzy on the details.
Okay, so HTTP, or Hypertext Transfer Protocol, it's the foundation of the web. It defines how those web browsers and servers talk to each other, sending those requests for web pages and receiving responses.
So it's like the language that websites and browsers speak.
Yeah, exactly. And HTTPS is the secure version of HTTP. It uses SSL/TLS encryption to protect your sensitive info, like passwords, credit card details, all that stuff.
So HTTP is like sending a postcard, and HTTPS is like sending a sealed envelope.
That's a great analogy. SSL/TLS is like the digital bodyguard.
Okay, so SSL and TLS, what are those exactly?
SSL stands for Secure Sockets Layer, and TLS is Transport Layer Security. They're cryptographic protocols that work together to secure communication over a network. They use a combination of symmetric and asymmetric encryption.
Whoa, hold on. Symmetric and asymmetric encryption, what's the difference?
Okay, so symmetric encryption uses the same key for both encrypting and decrypting data, like having one key that locks and unlocks a door. Asymmetric, on the other hand, uses two separate keys, a public key and a private key. You can share the public key freely, but the private key is kept secret.
So it's like having a mailbox with a slot for incoming mail. anyone can drop a letter in, but only the person with the key can open the mailbox and get the mail.
Exactly. And SSL TLS uses both these types of encryption to make a really robust security mechanism. So during an HTTPS connection, your browser and the web server, they exchange digital certificates, which have the server's public key.
So the certificate is like a digital ID card verifying the server's identity.
Exactly. And your browser uses that public key to encrypt the data, and only the server with its matching private key can decrypt it.
Okay. Starting to appreciate how complex online security is. Now, you mentioned SSL TLS uses modern encryption methods. Are there any historical examples of encryption we should know about?
Oh yeah, there are some fascinating ones. The Alberti cipher that used a rotating disk to encrypt messages. The Jefferson wheel that was developed by Thomas Jefferson used a series of rotating disks. And of course, there's the Enigma machine, the one the Germans used in World War II.
Whoa, encryption has quite a history.
Yeah.
And what about those modern methods you mentioned?
So the modern ones include DES, triple DES, and RSA. RSA is widely used, and it relies on that public-private key concept we talked about.
Okay, so DES, triple DES, and RSA. Those are the big names.
Right.
Okay, got it. Now let's go back to wired networks and talk about Ethernet and LANs. What's the deal with this Ethernet frame format?
So think of an Ethernet frame as a package being shipped over the network. It has a specific format to make sure the data is delivered correctly. It has a header, a payload, and a trailer.
Okay, so the header is like the shipping label, the payload is the actual contents, and the trailer is like the packing slip.
Perfect analogy. And the trailer usually includes a frame check sequence, or FCS, that's a checksum used for error detection.
So it's like a quality control check, make sure the package wasn't damaged along the way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned a type field in the header, right? That's important for multiplexing, which lets different protocols share the same physical network.
So if the type field says IPv4, the data gets passed on to the IP protocol stack.
Precisely. Now, the slides also talk about a difference between conventional Ethernet and 802.3 Ethernet.
Okay, I'm all ears.
So conventional Ethernet uses that type field to directly indicate the protocol type, like we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
802.3 Ethernet, it actually interprets that type field as the packet length. Can get a little confusing, so 802.3 adds an extra header called the LLCSNAP header.
So it's like adding an extra label to clarify the contents of the packet.
Exactly. Make sure everything is backward compatible.
Okay. Compatibility is key. Now let's talk about network interface cards, or NICs. They're the unsung heroes that connect our computers to the network, right?
Absolutely. NICs, they act as a bridge between your computer's internal data bus and the external network cable. They handle things like address recognition, computing that checksum we talked about, recognizing the frame format, and data communication.
So they're the ones that that package and transmit the data according to that Ethernet frame format.
Precisely. Now, Ethernet wiring has it's gone through some changes over the years. Your slides talk about ThickNet, ThinNet, and Twisted Pair.
Yeah, I've seen those terms before, but not exactly sure what they mean.
Okay, so ThickNet, that was the original coax cable they used for Ethernet. Bulky and hard to work with. ThinNet, also coax, was thinner and more flexible. But Twisted Pair cabling, that's the most common one today. It's cheaper, more flexible, and less susceptible to interference.
Right. Twisted pair is what we usually use for our Ethernet connections these days. What about those different categories of twisted pair Ethernet, like 10BASE-T and 100BASE-TX?
Those categories, they tell you about the data rate and the type of cable being used. So 10BASE, that's 10 male pays over unshielded twisted pair. 100BASE-TX, that's 100 male mies over category 5 twisted pair.
Okay, so the higher the category number, the faster the data can travel.
Yep.
Got it. Now let's move on to LAN topologies, different ways to connect devices in a local area network. The slides list bus, ring, mesh, and star topologies.
All right, so a bus topology uses a single cable, often called the backbone. All the devices are connected to that.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of a bus topology?
Well, it's simple and cheap to set up, so it's good for small networks. But if that main cable breaks, the whole network goes down. And as you add more devices, performance can suffer because of collisions.
Okay, so simplicity versus reliability. What about ring topology?
In a ring topology, the devices are connected in a circle. Data travels around the ring in one direction, and each device checks the data.
So it's like a game of hot potato with data packets.
Yeah, exactly. One good thing is, if one cable breaks, the data can still flow in the other direction, more fault tolerant than a bus. But adding or removing devices can be tricky.
Got it. What about mesh topology?
Mesh topology is all about redundancy and resilience. In a mesh network, every device is connected to multiple other devices, so there are many paths for the data to travel, like having a network of roads with a bunch of alternative routes.
That sounds super reliable. What's the catch?
The catch is that it's complex and expensive to set up.
Makes sense. Complexity and cost, always factors to consider. Finally, star topology. That sounds familiar. Is that the most common type of LAN topology?
Yeah, star topology is the most popular one today. In a star network, all devices are connected to a central hub or switch.
Like a bicycle wheel.
Exactly. And the reason it's so popular is that it's easy to install, easy to manage. Adding or removing devices is simple, and you get good performance because each device has its own bandwidth.
So star topology wins for ease of use, manageability, and performance. No wonder it's the go-to for most LANs. Okay, that wraps up LAN topologies. But we can't talk about networks without addressing security and reliability, right?
Yeah.
What happens when things go wrong and data gets lost or corrupted? How do we make sure our messages get to their destination safely?
That's a great question. Data transmission, it's not always perfect. There are all sorts of things that can introduce errors and potentially corrupt the information. Your slides mentioned three types of transmission errors. Single bit errors, burst errors, and erasure.
Okay, let's break those down. What's a single bit error?
A single bit error is when only one bit in a unit of data gets flipped from a 0 to a 1 or vice versa. It's like a tiny typo.
And a burst error?
A burst error affects multiple bits in a row, like a whole sentence getting jumbled up.
Ouch. That sounds worse. What about erasure?
Erasure is when the signal is lost or so corrupted that you can't even tell what the original bit was. It's like a whole word getting wiped out.
Okay, so we have single bit errors, burst errors, and erasure.
Yeah.
How do we deal with these errors? How do we make sure our data arrives intact even when the transmission isn't perfect?
That's where error detection and correction come into play. They're like having a spell checker for your data. They help to make sure your data stays intact by, you know, identifying and fixing any errors that happen during transmission.
Okay, so it's like having a spell checker for our data.
Exactly. Your lecture slides talk about a few common techniques: parity checking, checksums, and CRC.
Parity checking. How does that one work?
Parity checking, it's pretty basic. You add an extra bit, a parity bit, to each unit of data. That parity bit is either a 0 or a 1, and it makes sure the total number of ones in that data unit is either even or odd, depending on what you choose. And then the receiver checks the parity, and if it doesn't match what's expected, it knows there's an error.
So it's like a quick count to see if everything adds up. Are there any limitations to parity checking?
It's good for single bit errors, but it can't always catch those multi-bit errors. For that, you need something stronger. Like checksums.
Checksums, okay. What are those?
Checksums are like a more advanced version of parity checking. You add up the values of all the data units in a message, and then you send that sum, called a checksum, along with the message. The receiver does the same calculation, compares its result to the received checksum. If they match, the data is good.
So it's like double checking the math, making sure everything adds up.
Right. Checksums are more reliable than parity checking, but they can still miss some errors. For even more accuracy, you've got CRC, cyclic redundancy check.
CRC, that sounds pretty intense.
CRC is a powerhouse. It uses a more complex math approach, something called polynomial division, to calculate a check value. That check value is added to the data, and the receiver does the same calculation. If their results match, you're golden.
Polynomial division. Sounds like a blast from the past class. But it's good to know we have these different levels of error detection, from simple parity checks to the heavy-duty CRC. What about error correction? Can these techniques also correct errors, or is that something else entirely?
Some techniques, like parity checking, they just detect the errors. Others, like CRC, they can actually be used with error correction techniques to fix the errors.
So CRC can detect and correct errors. That's pretty impressive. What are some of those error correction techniques?
One common way is to use ARQ mechanisms, automatic repeat request. These are protocols that let the receiver ask for the data to be resent if any errors are found.
So if the receiver sees a problem, it basically says, hold on, send that again.
Yeah, pretty much. There are different types of ARQ mechanisms, each with its own way of handling those retransmissions. Stop and wait, go back in, and selective repeat are some of the common ones.
Okay, so ARQ mechanisms are like the safety net of data transmission. Now let's shift gears a bit. Your slides mention IPv6, the future of the internet. Why do we need a new version of IP addressing? What's wrong with good old IPv4?
IPv4 has been around forever, but it's starting to show its age. The biggest issue is that we're running out of addresses. You know, with all these internet-connected devices from smartphones to smart refrigerators, that 32-bit address space of IPv4 just isn't enough.
So we're basically running out of digital street addresses for all these new gadgets.
Exactly. And IPv6 solves that problem. It uses 128-bit addresses, so there's way more room for everyone.
More addresses, okay.
Yeah.
But are there any other advantages to IPv6, or is it just about having more addresses?
Oh, there are other benefits too. IPv6 has better security features, built-in support for quality of service, and it's more efficient. It's like upgrading from a rotary phone to a smartphone.
Okay, big upgrade. Now, what does an IPv6 address actually look like? It must be pretty long. With 128 bits.
Yeah, it would be a nightmare to try and remember a 128-bit address using binary.
No kidding.
Luckily, IPv6 addresses use hexadecimal notation, which makes them a lot easier to handle. They have 8 16-bit hexadecimal segments, and those are separated by colons.
So instead of dots, we have colons.
Got it. And just like IPv4, IPv6 has different address types like unicast, multicast, and anycast.
Unicast, multicast, anycast. Those sound familiar. Didn't we talk about those with the MAC addresses?
Yeah, good memory. They mean basically the same thing with IP addresses. Unicast is one-to-one, multicast is one-to-many, and anycast is for sending a message to the nearest server in a group.
Got it. So how's the transition from IPv4 to IPv6 going? It's probably not a flip the switch kind of thing, right?
Right. It's happening gradually. They're using techniques like dual stack and tunneling so IPv4 and IPv6 can coexist. Dual stack lets devices use both versions at the same time. And tunneling basically wraps IPv6 packets inside IPv4 packets so they can travel across those older networks.
So it's like having a bilingual internet.
Exactly. Devices can speak both languages. And while the transition's still happening, it's pretty clear that IPv6 is the future.
IPv6 is the way to go. Okay, got it. Now, we've covered a ton of stuff here. Number systems, data representation, all those network fundamentals, protocols, wireless, security, and even a glimpse into the future with IPv6. My brain is officially full.
Yeah, we've been doing some serious deep diving, but we're not done yet. Your lecturer was nice enough to include some sample exam questions, ready to put all this knowledge to the test.
Bring it on. Feeling a lot more confident now that we've go through all these concepts. Let's see if I can actually apply what I've learned.
Okay, let's start with a simple binary to decimal conversion. The question is, what is 1011 in decimal?
Okay, I remember this. Each position in the binary number is a power of 2, increasing from right to left. So starting from the rightmost digit, it's 1 times 2 to the 0 plus 1 times 2 to the 1 plus 0 times 2 to the 2 plus 0 times 2 to the 3 plus 1 times 2 to the 4.
Keep going.
Let's see. That's 1 plus 2 plus 0 plus 0 plus 16. So 1011 in binary is equal to 19 in decimal.
Nailed it. Now let's try converting a decimal number to binary. How about 562?
All right. Challenge accepted. To convert 562 to binary, we need to find the largest powers of 2 that fit into it. So the largest one is 512, which is 2 to the power of 9.
Perfect. So you'll have a 1 in the 2 to the 9th place. What next?
We subtract 512 from 562, and that leaves us with 50. The next largest power of 2 that fits is 32, which is 2 to the 5th. So another one goes there.
Keep going.
Okay, we've got 18 left. So that means we need a 1 in the 2 to the 4th place, which is 16, and then a 1 in the 2 to the 1st place, which is 2, to make it the remaining 2. So the final binary representation is 10011. 00LZL for 562.
Spot on. You're a binary conversion master. Now let's move on to hexadecimal. What is 12 in decimal expressed in hexadecimal?
Okay, hexadecimal, base 16, uses 0 through 9 and then A through F to represent values from 0 to 15. So to convert 12 in decimal to hexadecimal, we need to see how many times 16 goes into 12. 16 doesn't fit into 12. So we just have the remainder, which is 12 itself.
And how do we represent 12 in hexadecimal?
Remember, A through F represents values from 10 to 15. So 12 in decimal is simply C in hexadecimal.
Exactly. So the answer is C. Let's do another one. What is 255 in decimal expressed in hexadecimal?
Okay, bigger number now. 255 divided by 16 gives us 15, with a remainder of 15.
And what's that in hexadecimal?
Both of those 15s are represented as F in hexadecimal. So the answer is FF.
You got it. Now, let's try some binary to hexadecimal conversion. What is 0100011 in hexadecimal?
Okay, should it be straightforward? We split the binary number into groups of 4 bits, starting from the right. and then convert each group to its hexadecimal equivalent.
Sounds good. What do you get?
0100 is 4 in hexadecimal, and 0011 is 3 in hexadecimal. So 0100, 00011 in binary is equal to 43 in hexadecimal.
Perfect. Now let's try reversing it. What is 72 in hexadecimal expressed in decimal?
Okay, so each position in a hexadecimal number is a power of 16. So 72 in hexadecimal equals 7 times 16 to the 1 plus 2 times 16 to the 0.
Break it down.
7 times 16 is 112, and 2 times 1 is 2. Add those together, we get 114. So 72 in hexadecimal equals 114 in decimal.
You're on a roll. Now let's wait with some ASCII. What character is represented by 4D in hexadecimal?
Ah, ASCII. Like a secret code. Time to consult the ASCII table.
Exactly. What do you find when you look up 4D?
It represents the uppercase letter M.
You cracked the code. Now let's move on to a byte rate calculation problem. So here's the scenario. We have a page of A4 text with 60 lines, 60 characters per line, each character coded in extended ASCII. And the COM port settings are one start bit, one stop bit, even parity, 8 data bits, and a bit rate, which is the same as the baud rate, of 9600 bits per second. The question is, how much time does it take to send one page through that COM port?
Okay, this one seems a little more involved. Let's take it step by step. First, we got to figure out how many bits it takes to send one character.
What do you have?
So we've got 8 data bits, one start bit, one stop bit, and one parity bit. That's 11 bits per character.
How many characters total?
60 characters per line. And 60 lines on the page, that's 3,600 characters total.
So how many bits for the whole page?
To send the whole page, it's 3,600 characters times 11 bits per character. So 39,600 bits.
What's the byte rate?
Byte rate is 9,600 bits per second.
So how do we calculate the transmission time?
We just divide the total number of bits by the byte rate. 39,600 bits divided by 9,600 bits per second gives us, let's see, about 4.125 seconds.
You got it. A little over 4 seconds to send that whole page. Not bad. Now let's talk about wireless communication. What are some advantages and disadvantages of using radio waves for data transmission?
Okay, radio transmissions are all over the place. Radio broadcasts, Wi-Fi, mobile phones, all that. The biggest advantage is, well, they're wireless. No need for those pesky cables, and they can go through walls, travel long distances, so perfect for mobile communication.
Good points. What about the downsides?
Well, they're prone to interference from other radio signals, and things like weather conditions can mess with them too. And of course, there's the security issue. They can be intercepted. Plus, their strength drops off over distance, and you need a line of sight for them to work properly.
Great summary. Now, how do those compare to satellite communications?
Satellites, they can cover a much wider area than ground-based radio transmissions. So they're good for things like broadcasting, navigation, and communication in those remote areas. And they're not as affected by interference from down here, but they're expensive, and atmospheric conditions could affect the signal. Plus, there's that delay because the signal's had to travel so far.
Yeah, that latency can be a real problem for some applications. Speaking of delays, let's try a question about satellite latency. How much delay is there when one bit is transmitted via a geostationary satellite?
Geostationary satellites, they stay in a fixed spot above Earth, so they provide continuous coverage. But that high altitude means the signals have a long way to go.
And the farther the distance, the longer the propagation delay.
Right, right. The round trip time for a signal to go up to a geostationary satellite and back down is typically around 250 milliseconds, so a quarter of a second.
Good. Let's get back to error detection with a checksum problem. Can you calculate the 8-bit checksum for these binary words? 1101001, 1111111, 1111, 1111100, and 1011001.
Checksum time. We gotta add up all those binary words and then find the one's complement of that sum. Let's see, adding them up, we get 1010101111. But wait a minute, we've got a carryover bit.
Right, you gotta add that carryover bit back to the least significant bit.
So adding that one to our sum, we get 0110101. Now we find the one's complement, which means flipping all the bits. That gives us 1011010 as our final 8-bit checksum.
Well done. Now how about a 16-bit checksum for the string? Fonties is great.
Okay, a 16-bit checksum for a string. First, we represent the string in binary using ASCII. Then we break that binary string into 16-bit chunks, add any padding if we need to, and then we sum up all those 16-bit words, handling any carryover bits like before. And finally, we take the one's complement to get our 16-bit checksum.
Exactly. Same concept as the 8-bit checksum, just working with bigger pieces of data. I'll let you work through that one on your own time since you need to look up those ASCII codes and do a bit of binary addition. Let's try a question about frames and transmission time. We have four computers, A, B, C, and D, connected to a shared medium. Computer A sends data to computer B using frames. Each frame has the structure. SOH, 8 bits, data, 32 bits, checksum, 8 bits, and EOT, 8 bits. First, we need to calculate the 8-bit checksum if the word FHTL is sent. Then, we got to figure out how long it takes to send one page of A4 text with 40 lines, 60 characters per line, including those line feed, LF, and carriage return CR characters, at a byte rate of 10,000 bits per second. And lastly, we got to calculate that transmission time again if the same page is sent from A to B. But now, computer C is also sending 30 megabits of data to computer D at the same time using 1,000-bit frames and packet-based multiplexing.
Wow, okay, this is a multi-part question. Let's tackle that checksum first, the one for FHTL. So we need to represent FHTL in binary using ASDI, break it down into those 8-bit segments, add them up, find the ones complement.
Don't forget those carryover bits.
Right. I'll come back to that calculation later. Let's figure out the transmission time for one page of text. 40 lines, 60 characters per line, including the line feed and carriage return, that's 2,400 characters in total.
Right. Each character is represented by 8 bits in ASCII.
So 2,400 characters times 8 bits per character, that's 19,200 bits to send. With a baint rate of 10,000 bits per second, the transmission time is 19,200 bits divided by 10,000 bits per second, which is 1.92 seconds.
Now for the tricky part, what happens when computer C starts sending data to D at the same time?
Since it's packet-based multiplexing, the data is broken down into packets and they share the transmission medium. I guess we can assume each computer gets equal time to transmit.
That's a safe assumption. So how do you figure out the new transmission time?
We need to calculate how long each transmission takes and then add those times together. We know A to B takes 1.92 seconds. Now we got to figure out how long it takes for C to send to D.
Good. C is sending 30 megabits of data, which is, 30,000 bit frames. So that's 30,000 bits divided by 1,000 bits per frame. So 30,000 frames in total.
With a byte rate of 10,000 bits per second, each frame takes 1,000 bits divided by 10,000 bits a second, which is 0.1 seconds to send.
So what's the total transmission time for C sending to D?
That's 30,000 frames times 0.1 seconds per frame. So 3,000 seconds. Now we add that to the 1.92 seconds for A to B. So with both computers sending data, the total transmission time is 3,001.92 seconds. That's a lot longer than that initial 1.92 seconds.
Huge difference. This shows how sharing the medium, even though it lets multiple transmissions happen, can really slow things down.
Yeah. Definitely a trade-off. Okay, on to the next question. We have a network packet capture. It shows us a hexadecimal dump of an Ethernet frame, and we need to find the destination MAS address, the source MAS address, and tell which protocol stack the data in the frame is being sent to.
All right, time for some digital detective work. Remember, MM addresses are in the header of the Ethernet frame, and each one is 6 bytes long, represented in hexadecimal.
Okay, looking at the packet capture, the destination MASI address is 0.19.07.85.bc.00, and the source MASI address is 22.f4.9in.2d.08.00.
Nice. What about the protocol stack?
That's in the EtherType field in the header. Tells us which protocol the payload data is for. In this capture, the EtherType value is 0800, which means it's IPv4.
So this data is headed for the IPv4 protocol stack. Great job. Now, a question about home networks. It asks about the typical equipment, how it's connected, and the addresses used internally and externally.
All right, time to take inventory of our home networks. Most of them have a router as the central device. It connects to the internet and often acts as a DHCP server, too.
A lot of routers these days have built-in switches for wired connections, too.
Right, and for wireless, most people have a wireless access point, maybe even multiple access points if they have a bigger house.
How are all those devices connected, typically?
The router usually connects to the modem, you know, the one your ISP provides, and then devices can connect to the router either wirelessly or through a wired Ethernet connection to the router's built-in switch.
What about those addresses, internal and external?
Each device that has a network interface card has a unique MPC address, which you can usually find in the network settings. And most home networks use both IPv4 and IPv6 addresses. The router assigns those private IPv4 addresses to devices within the network, and the ISP assigns a public IPv4 address to the router itself.
So you've got private IPs for internal communication and a public IP for talking to the outside world. What about IPv6?
IPv6 addresses are also assigned to devices either automatically or using DHCPv6. So, yeah, a mix of IPv4 and IPv6 on a typical home network.
Nice. Now, a question about IP address classes, subnet masks, and those special addresses. What's the binary representation of the IP address 145.192.3.27?
So to get the binary representation, we convert each decimal part to its 8-bit binary equivalent. So 145 is 101,001, 192 is 100,000, 3 is 00000000011, and 27 is 00001011. So the full binary representation for 145.192.3.27 is 100,000,000, about 110,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,
254, 0.254, 0.248, 0.2.
To figure out the class, we got to look at the first few bits of the first octet. Class A addresses start with a 0, class B with 10, class C with 178, which is 0000100 in binary. Starts with a 0, so it's class A. 175.41.92.239 starts with 175, which is 0000011 in binary, another class A. And lastly, 211.255.255.255, that starts with 12, which is 0000011 in binary. That was class C because it starts with 110. Perfect, you're getting this. Now, how many bits are in the suffix and prefix of these IP addresses? 223.43.24.254, 126.151.3.1, 128.21.6, and 193.288.23.
Okay, for this, we need to remember those default subnet masks for the different classes. Class A's default mask is 255.0.0.0, which is 8 in CIDR notation. Class B's is 255.255.0.0, or 16, and class C's is 255.255.255.255, or that's in class C, so it's got a default prefix length of 24, which means the suffix is 8 bits long. 126.151.3.1 and 128.21.6, those are both class A, so they've got prefix length of 8 and suffix length of 24 bits. And 193.257.188.23, that's another class C, so also a 24 prefix and 8-bit suffix.
You're a CIDR whiz. Now, building on that, how many hosts and networks can each of those addresses accommodate?
The number of hosts you can have depends on how many bits are in the suffix, you know, the host part of the address. With n bits in the suffix, you can have 2 to the power of n possible host addresses. But we've got to remember to subtract 2 for the network and broadcast addresses. So for 223.43.24.254 and 193.257.188.23, which both have those 8-bit suffixes, we can have 2 to the 8th minus 2. That's 254 usable addresses. And for those class A addresses, 126.151.3.1 and 128.2.21.6, they've got those 24-bit suffixes. So we have 2 to the 24th minus 2, which is a lot, 16,777,214.
And how about the number of networks?
That depends on the prefix. Class A, with that 8-bit prefix, allows for 256 networks. Class B, with a 16-bit prefix, allows for 55,536 networks. And Class C, with its 24-bit prefix, allows for, a whole lot of networks, 16,777,216 to be exact.
Wow, impressive.
Yeah.
Now let's see what you know about those special IP addresses. What kind of addresses are these? 0.20.0, so it's 0.0.1, 10.10.12.220, 172.24.62.32, and 192.168.60.34.
Okay, 0.0.0, that's the special one, indicates the default route. Or it can be the source address when a device doesn't have an IP address yet. 127.27 or 20.1, that's the loopback address. You use that to test network connectivity on your own machine. And those last three, 10.10, 0.12.220, 172.2.62.32, and 192.168.60.34, those are all private IP addresses. They're not routable on the public internet.
You're like an IP address encyclopedia. Now, another packet capture. This one shows us a hexadecimal dump of an IP packet. Can you spot the destination IP address?
Destination IP address, that's in bytes 16 through 19 of the IP header. Let's see, looking at the capture, the destination IP address is 91.55.55.55.11, or 5B.37.37.0B in hexadecimal.
The question also asks why this frame might not arrive at the destination. Any ideas?
Well, the destination IP address could be wrong, or maybe it's unreachable, or maybe there's a routing problem. Could be that the packet itself is messed up, corrupted, or incomplete. Hard to say without more information about the network and what's actually in the packet.
Good points. All right, a routing table exercise. We've got a diagram of a network with a router and several subnets, and we need to fill out the routing table for that router.
Okay, time to put on those network admin hats. Remember, routing tables tell the router where to send those packets based on their destination IP addresses.
To fill it out, we need to look at the network diagram, figure out the right path for each destination network.
Exactly. For directly connected networks, the next hop will be the router's own IP address. For networks that are not directly connected, we got to figure out the next hop router or the gateway.
Okay, got it. I'm going to need some time to really study that network diagram and work that one out. What about this network configuration question? It shows us a screenshot of a network settings window and asks what's wrong with the configuration.
Configuration errors, those can be tricky. You got to really examine those settings. Look for anything that's out of place.
Right. Look for wrong IP addresses, subnet masks, maybe the gateway's messed up, duplicate IPs on the network, or the DNS server settings are wrong. Lots to check. Definitely need a keen eye for detail to catch those. Okay, let's do some IPv6 subnetting. We need to configure a network with two subnets, A and B, given the provider-assigned IPv6 address of 2001.db8.aja. We need to start with the link local addresses, then assign global unicast addresses.
All right, IPv6 subnetting. Link local addresses are for communication within the local network, and they always start with FE80.0. We can assign a unique identifier to each device in each subnet. So for subnet A, we could use FE80.1 for the router, FE80.2 for a computer, and so on. And for subnet B, we'll use a different set of identifiers.
What about those global unicast addresses?
We'll use that provider-assigned prefix, 2001.db8.ablea, and we'll create 64 subnets within that address space. Subnet A gets the first 64 blocks, subnet B gets the second 64 block.
Can you give me an example for each subnet?
Sure. Subnet A could have addresses like 2001.db8.ablea.1 for the router, 2001.db8.ablea.2 for a computer, and so on. Subnet B would have addresses like 2001.db8.ablea.1.1, 2001.db8.ablea.2, and so on.
Perfect. Now, some hands-on network analysis with Wireshark. We got to analyze some TCP traffic, find the connection setup, and also analyze some UDP traffic.
Wireshark is great for capturing and analyzing network traffic. To focus on TCP traffic, we can use a filter, like just TCP.
Right. What are we looking for in the TCP traffic?
We're looking for that three-way handshake that sets up a TCP connection. So a SYN packet from the client, a SYN ACK from the server, and then the final ACK from the client.
And for UDP traffic?
We can filter for UDP and look at those UDP datagrams. UDP is connectionless, so we won't see that three-way handshake like with TCP.
Right. You can tell which applications or services are using UDP by looking at the source and destination port numbers in those datagrams.
Okay, I'm looking forward to firing up Wireshark and seeing this stuff in action. What about this last question about HTTPS and those key exchange messages? We need to open an HTTPS site in Wireshark and find those messages.
This is all about that secure communication we talked about earlier. HTTPS uses SSLTLS for encryption, and those key exchange messages are how that secure connection gets started.
They're like the secret handshake before the secure conversation can begin.
Exactly.
Right, they involve exchanging those digital certificates and negotiating the encryption keys.
Exactly. It's like a secret handshake before they can start talking securely.
I'll definitely give that a try later. Capture some HTTPS traffic in Wireshark and see if I can spot those key exchange messages.
That's the spirit. Exploring real-world examples with Wireshark is a great way to really understand those network protocols and security.
Well, I think we pretty much covered everything on these lecture slides. Number systems, data representation, network basics, protocols, wireless security, and we even touched on IPv6. My brain is officially fried.
You've absorbed a ton of information, that's for sure. Remember, for the exam, it's not just about memorizing. You got to understand the concepts, how it all fits together.
Right. Seeing the big picture, being able to actually apply what you've learned to different situations.
Exactly. And don't forget to practice those conversions and calculations. Those sample questions we went through are a good start, but there are tons of resources out there to help you prepare.
And hey, if you need any extra help, you know where to find us.
Absolutely. Good luck with the exam.
You got this. Until next time, happy studying, and may your networks always be fast, secure, and full of those delicious data packets.